From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, August 29th, 2017. And on this day, a program that funds park and forest projects in Maine is caught up in uncertainty about the federal budget. And teaching financial literacy in school. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The future of the federal land and water conservation program that has helped fund $183 million worth of projects in Maine since 1965 is once again uncertain. As Mal Leary reports, it's caught up in ongoing discussions over President Trump's proposed budget.
Hundreds of park and forest projects across the state have been helped by the Land and Water Conservation Fund programs. Rangeley State Park, the Bigelow Preserve, and the Allagash Wilderness Waterway are among the beneficiaries. Caitlin Bernard with the Appalachian Mountain Club says a good example of how the program protects a broad range of interests is the Cold Stream Project in western Maine.
It included hunting and fishing and ATV access. It included some sustainable harvesting, forest tree harvesting, but also a big recreation component. So traditional recreation, hiking, biking, you name it, it had it.
President Trump has proposed slashing funding for the program from $400 million a year to $64 million. And Bernard says that would stifle efforts to expand and improve public lands in the state. Independent Maine Senator Angus King agrees.
This is an important program. It provides recreation projects, facilities, helps states and towns acquire recreational lands. It's one that over many years has supported lots of projects in Maine.
King says the state and local communities would be hard-pressed to make up the loss of the federal funding. He serves on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where members of both parties have expressed concerns about the proposal. First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree serves on the House Appropriations Committee that has voted to restore some of the money.
We restored some of the money, but it still had a cut of over 30%. There's definitely bipartisan support for restoring that funding.
The House committee vote was for a funding level of $275 million. But Senator Susan Collins says that is not enough. But she's confident the Senate will support a higher funding level.
I think it's much more likely that it will either be flat funded at the level of last year or that it will receive only a very minor decrease.
Republican Congressman Bruce Poliquin also opposes deep cuts to the program. He's co-sponsoring an amendment to restore funding to last year's levels. The House and Senate will have to iron out the differences by the end of September. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
This week, students across the state will be hopping on the bus and heading back to school, some with their lunch money just burning a hole in their pockets. Over the past few years, some districts have made a big push to teach students about financial literacy. Robbie Feinberg reports that in the wake of the Great Recession, many teachers are adding credit cards and student loans to their curriculum.
Math teacher Brett Schifrin remembers one specific day in 2008 when it became clear to him just how little his students understood about banking. The financial crisis was just beginning, and Schifrin's school, Gould Academy in Bethel, had invited two experts to campus to talk about its causes, risky mortgages and loans that people couldn't pay back.
The next day, I just opened up my classes to, like, what questions you have from last night's speaker or about finance or anything, and I had, across the board in my courses, kids asking me questions for over an hour. What was going on? What does an auto loan mean? What does it mean to invest? Just all sorts of questions. So they were hearing about money, and money became like part of the conversation. And I don't think that was ever front and center.
That stream of questions made Schifrin rethink how he should teach math. he created a new course at Gould specifically designed around financial literacy. Instead of teaching statistics or calculus, Shiffrin designed a class to explain math concepts by talking about credit cards, mortgages, and student loans.
What I want kids to do is be able to be in any financial situation and be able to slow it down to their comfort level.
And so we continue to see more and more schools that are adding a course.
Mary Dyer is the president of Maine's Jumpstart Coalition, which provides financial literacy training for teachers. She says she's seen a big jump in the inclusion of financial literacy classes like the one at Gould. Research suggests they're badly needed. One recent study found that less than a third of students understand concepts like interest rates and inflation.
There's just such a gap in knowledge and awareness that, you know, has such a huge impact in so many areas. And so the more that we can expose students, and as they get older, giving them sort of that experiential, you know, opportunity, that's a huge benefit as well.
So I'm assuming it's going to be mostly like not much money spent in the morning, but later on.
Here at Massabesic High School in Waterboro, that comes in the form of a class called Financial Algebra. The teacher, Hattie Bellagrino, is a former banker, and she says the class emphasizes practical lessons. For example, in one activity, students plan out a monthly budget with their classmates as roommates.
So I try to relate it to their world. You know, we talk about who has a job, who doesn't have a job, who has a car.
Seniors Nathaniel Henry, April Allen, and Aaron Trost initially struggle with the lesson. They're unsure how much groceries cost and how to split up the budget. But Trost says he appreciates the challenge because he doesn't know how he'd learn these skills otherwise.
The internet is really, that would be the one thing, but even then, just in general, I don't think I would be able to learn.
If you actually like wanted to learn about this, this would be the class to go to, because no other class offers what this class does.
And in my opinion, this class is the most world like class where they actually teach you how to prepare for the real world.
Principal Jim Hand says the class is part of the school's emphasis on teaching what he calls 21st century skills. Skills like how to interview for a job or apply for a student loan. Hand says he still sees many students taking unnecessary financial risks.
They'll take out a credit card because they're offering a flashy new hat.
But he thinks the classes have made a difference, and the school is considering making financial literacy mandatory.
That when we looked at it, we said, this is something we want all kids to have. It just seemed like the right next step, I guess.
Across the state, there's still plenty of room for growth. Schools are required to teach financial literacy under the state social studies standards. But a 2009 survey from the Maine Jumpstart Coalition found that less than half of them are teaching the subject. Christy Littlefield, a Jumpstart board member and a former state social studies specialist, says resources have declined for social studies nationally because the subject is no longer assessed on standardized tests.
It's just an unfortunate consequence, if you will, over many years of the erosion of social studies education, not just in Maine, but really across the country.
But Littlefield is encouraged by these new efforts to specifically train teachers around financial literacy. And she hopes that schools see the value in teaching kids about not only history and algebra, but credit cards and loans, too. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And education reporting on Maine Public Radio is supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. Finally today, biologists worldwide are saving seeds from crops and from plants important to the ecosystem. In New England, 22% of the region's native plants are considered rare, and some are on the federal list of endangered species. Seed banking is one attempt to stop them from disappearing entirely. As the New England News Collaborative's Jill Kaufman reports, collectors are stepping up their pace.
There is a seed ark in Framingham, Massachusetts, at Garden in the Woods, a place as beautiful as its name. Bill Brumback, conservation director at the New England Wildflower Society, unlocks the door to the cinder block building that houses the ark, or vault. It looks exactly like the extra freezer you might keep in your garage, except for what's inside. Brumback raises the lid.
Okay, there are only rare seeds in this vault.
About a million rare seeds in sealed foil packets. Handwritten labels note the species name, where and when the seeds were gathered, and if the electricity goes out.
Seeds in a freezer is not like meat that's going to spoil. You're talking about things that may have a shelf life, if you will, of hundreds of years.
Some seeds may lose their viability, and scientists will be testing for that over time. For something so vital, the setup and security is rather unremarkable. It's not Fort Knox. It's not even Fort Collins in Colorado, where seeds for the National Apple Collection live. What is remarkable is that Brumback has been collecting the seeds from rare native plants since 1982.
Well, it was a good idea back then, and that was before climate change became more notorious.
Other threats to plant life have been around a long time. Deforestation, reforestation, dammed up rivers, growing cities and suburbs, even something as unassuming as a public trail. About 2,400 plants are considered native New Englanders, like Jess's milk vetch.
She's found in three places in the world, all along a 16-mile stretch of the Connecticut River in New Hampshire and Vermont.
Brumback is also worried about Castilleja.
It's a paintbrush, Indian paintbrush, and it's now only found in Connecticut. It was much, much wider than that.
Ecologists occasionally break into the vault and use seeds to reintroduce plants to their natural habitat. Brumback's big goal is to fill the ark with seeds from approximately 300 rare native species by 2020. That's thousands of seeds per species from multiple locations. At last count, with the help of hundreds of trained volunteers, a lot of private and some public money, they were about halfway there. Brumback says he needs another freezer. More seeds are coming.
I'm Elizabeth Farnsworth, and I'm senior research ecologist with New England Wildflower Society. And I am curating our collections of seed from rare plant populations.
Farnsworth is based in western Massachusetts. The Wildflower Society has a plant farm and its seed dehydration equipment in Wheatley. Farnsworth is looking at GoBotany, a plant identification website. She shows me a picture of a rare glaucescent sedge.
And here are the seeds that we're going to collect, or the fruits, I should say, that have the seeds inside them.
And is it at that stage right now?
We certainly hope so.
To me, that rare sedge looks like a clump of grass. But Farnsworth says, once I see it in the wild, I'll never not see it again. That is, if we can find it. And it's a species she's rather fond of.
Back in 2001, it was still known as Carex flaccosperma, var glaucodia.
Farnsworth gets serious when she tells me, I can't tell you where we're going. Scientists are very protective of rare plants. They don't want civilian Johnny Appleseeds over-collecting and planting in the wrong spots.
All right, shall we start walking?
It's raining. It's a beautiful walk. And we walk and walk and double back. We go off trail, up a steep incline.
As we head a little bit deeper into the forest, I expect to see actually much of these herbaceous plants sort of drop out. We'll be looking for these guys.
Fingers crossed, Farnsworth says as she walks on.
And I'm looking for that characteristic sort of blue-greenish color.
There's a little opening in the tree cover, and Farnsworth is sure this is where she last found the sedge.
I will say I'm a bit puzzled. Just may not be my lucky day here.
In the next few minutes, she sees several other varieties, but not the rare glaucescent. Farnsworth stops, and she picks something up and looks at it for a while with the magnifying lens she wears around her neck.
I believe it is our glaucescent sedge, even though it doesn't look particularly glaucous in the pouring rain. They're so past at this point. They're actually very overmature, shall we say. So I may have gotten out here just a little too late. But at least we know that there's still one or two of these guys. A little clump over there.
While the survival of humankind doesn't depend on finding this one rare sedge today, Farnsworth says the entire ecosystem is at risk.
So you lose a plant, you lose everything that depends upon it. And if you lose enough plants, you lose many of the important services that they provide to us as humans.
Like oxygen and medicine and, of course, food. We're hungry, and Farnsworth happens to find some tiny blueberries on a bush right near where she found the sedge. The seed ark may never be fully needed, but Farnsworth says the climate science is irrefutable. It could make an ecologist, among others, not want to get out of bed in the morning. Though, she says you do see plants come back from the brink. Like Henry David Thoreau before her, Elizabeth Farnsworth has faith in a seed. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Jill Kaufman.
For yet more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, August 29th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.